I've often heard that the eye has an error and that it's the blind spot. And people say that what kind of a God would design an eye with a blind spot? It's no God. So I was wondering, how do you guys respond to that? Did that make any sense? You look like it didn't make sense, Mr. Kokel.
You don't get that, Greg?
No, I understand it, but I don't see that this is a big problem. I mean, if you put it this way, that God made an eye with a blind spot, what kind of God would do that, then it sounds problematic. But if you realize that any particular thing that you create for any particular function is going to have, by the nature of the physical object itself, certain kinds of limitations, then... Well, for example, that's not the biggest problem with the eye. The bigger problem with the eye is it can't turn around backwards and look at the brain. Why would God create an eye that can't turn around backwards and look at the brain? Because
I wonder that all the time.
You see what I'm saying? Well, the answer is because if its real intention is to see what's out there, then to design it to look at the brain wouldn't accomplish what God wants it to accomplish. If he designs it to accomplish one particular task, then it doesn't accomplish some other task it wasn't designed to accomplish. Now, the way the blind spot works into this is that the nature of seeing entails in the design that God offered an optic nerve that feeds the impressions back to the gray matter, and that optic nerve doesn't have sight capacity. That's where the blind spot comes from. It's not that he's created an eye that doesn't work adequately. It's just that the nature of the design that he chose entails, because of the design, a blind spot. I don't see how that's a limitation. I mean, if anybody has more to add, but...
I would only add that we need more sound out of my microphone. That you got to be careful with the language there. Blind spot sounds like some inappropriate limitation just because you've called it a blindness. Well, it's not blindness. As Greg said, there's a design and there's a limitation, any design plan. It does what it does, what it's supposed to do very well, but it has a limited range of vision. Your eye has a limited range of vision that doesn't include a certain spot, and it really shouldn't be called a blind spot, because it's not really an inadequacy or a fault of the eye that it doesn't do that.
Very good. I heard vitamin B is good for eyesight, too, so you might want to check into that.
My question is addressed to Doug, or actually anybody else who would like to answer this. But the reason I addressed it to Doug is because as far as the... what you were talking about postmodern Christianity or the myth of, and you said that our beliefs are based on what we think is true, and we gather what is true based on evidence. And I was just wondering how faith, you know, where we have to take in some beliefs that we don't have any evidence for, how does that really work when we're dealing with non-Christians?
Well, I'm problem solved. Somebody out there want to hold this for me? Look, I don't want to believe anything without evidence. Now, does that mean that there's no room for faith in my life? See, I don't think so. Regardless of the evidence we have, we still have to act on.
Can I add something?
Yeah,
sure. I was on the plane flight here yesterday, and I sat next to a guy who asked me like that very question. You know, he basically said, you know, you guys just have faith. You know, you don't have any, you know, reason for why you believe what you believe. Whatever. I said, here's the deal. You need to understand. This particular guy was an atheist, and I said to him, I said, the thing you need to understand is that every single person in the world has faith. I don't care who you are. Even atheists have faith. They have faith that their belief that there is no God is true, okay? Everybody has faith. And so I said to the man, I said, the question you need to ask yourself is what you're putting your faith into, do you have a valid and reasonable basis for your faith in that thing? Because we all have faith. What are you putting your faith into, and do you have a valid and reasonable basis for your faith in that? That's the question you need to ask somebody.
Yeah, I would say, too, that an example of that right now is we're all expressing our faith in man's ability to build chairs that support our weight, but that's based on good evidence. So, you know, somebody's faith, is it based on good evidence or is it not based on good evidence? So I see faith and reason working together when your faith is based on the evidence.
Yeah, one thing I like about Phil is, you know, yesterday I did the my Columbo impersonation. He can do it without even trying. Phil, if you just put your hand at your head here and just rub your brow a little and say anything, and it's Lieutenant Columbo, right?
Yeah, everybody says Columbo, but I like to think of myself more as like the Robert De Niro type.
Yeah, right. small thing that might help in this discussion, we talked about this in our last session here, specifically about this issue of faith. I think the word faith, the word faith is a word that I avoid like the plague because there's too much misunderstanding about it. I think it's taken on a connotation that is different than the original Greek word intended. I think a different word in English that captures the original meaning better, since the word faith now can be appended with words like blind or leap of, and that's what people think when they hear the word faith. I think it's better to use the word trust, keeping in mind that trust is something that's generally earned and trust is something that's active. And the active part of it is what Doug was talking about here. You know, we could say we believe things, but if we aren't acting as if we believe that, then we can question how much we actually believe those things. It's acting on what we say is so. And Jason was pointing out the evidence that everybody puts their trust in something. Sometimes they put their trust foolishly. They invest it foolishly. But our goal as Christians is to invest it wisely. I suggest just getting away from that word faith, which I think creates some of the problem, and just talk about trust. And these other concepts that have been discussed can be integrated very well. Trusting the chair when you sit. It's implicit in sitting down in the chair. So.
Hi. I'm just wondering, is there any value, do you think, in explaining the Bible's view on the role of the devil in a discussion of evil in the world? And, I mean, I know he's not the only source of evil in the world, but he's one source of evil, and the Bible does have an explanation that since he's been giving dominion over the earth. I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I actually think that most of the church today, the evangelical church, we kind of suffer from what I would call a contemporary Christian deism, where because of the influence of modernism and, you know, ultra-rationalism, we decided not to talk about certain things like the miraculous and act like the miracles and demons. That stuff happened in the past, but it really doesn't happen anymore. And I think we've reached such a point that, you know, here the New Age movement, many New Agers are coming up with all the answers to these paranormal things that are occurring. And I really think we as a church, we have some catching up to do. I think Dr. Michael Heiser, who works for the Logos software, he's right in Washington. He's gone a long way. He's got his PhD in Hebrew and Semitic languages, and he's taking seriously a lot of the New Age talk about demons and things of that sort. But he's very biblically based and solid. But he's attempting to answer questions that you know, many thinkers in the church are avoiding. Norman Geisler does a good job with his dealing with the problem of evil, as mentioned, and that demons do play a role in some of the evil that we face. So,
I think Phil's right that they do play. I just think there may be a strategic problem with using that element to help answer the problem of evil. Because let's just say the devil was completely responsible for all evil in the world. Would that help us in any way answer the problem of evil? I don't see how it does. Let's just say there wasn't any devil at all. Would there be enough evil left over for that to raise a problem? I think, with specifically replying to your question, is this a good tactic to use or strategy to use in dealing with the problem? I don't see how it'd be helpful, because if you can convince people that there is a devil, I think for other reasons that might be important, as Phil has pointed out, I don't think it would help you on the problem of evil at all.
This question is directed mostly towards Mr. Carlson, but, you know, anyone else can jump in too. You seem to know a lot about other cultures, and you also seem to know a lot about evolution. And so I was wondering if you know if different cultures have different opinions and beliefs about evolution.
Well, there are. It's interesting when you study different cultures. There are many different, like, what are called creation mythologies about the different stories of creation. And what you find, what I find fascinating when you study the different creation mythologies, it's very interesting. Virtually all of them go back to the idea of one supreme original creator God. And so I think that speaks as pretty strong evidence in support of the biblical cosmology of a biblical worldview created by a creator God. And I think what you find there is if the biblical story is true, and if we were created by God, and if the world was destroyed by a flood, and if Noah and his three sons repopulated the earth, it's very interesting. Why at 5,000 BC do you find all of the three major world civilizations developing at virtually the same time? You find Egypt, you find Mesopotamia, you find India all developing at virtually the same time at around 5,000 BC. Okay, they all share common similar creation stories. They all share common stories about a flood and a small handful of human beings that survived and escaped. So I think a lot of these different religious explanations for the origins of life tie in very well with a biblical account of creation. Is that helpful? Now, you'll certainly find evolution embraced in cultures all over the world as well. So, you know, I've been all over the world, and I actually speak on the evolution versus creation debate virtually everywhere I go, because it is such a huge issue in our world today. It's not just in America and Europe where evolution is becoming or has become like one of the foundational bedrocks of science. So you do have to deal with that in virtually every culture as well.
I would ask you, the cultures that you find that are embracing evolution, have they been taught it by the West, or have you found some like tribal peoples who come up with evolutionary theories.
Yeah, that's actually pretty interesting. I don't think you find, from like an anthropological standpoint, I don't think you find many tribal or primal cultures that haven't had a whole lot of exposure with the Western world developing an idea of evolutionary origins on their own. That is basically a Western phenomenon that has been transplanted from the West. So again, you ask the question, well, what do you find in the creation stories of these more tribal cultures? And I think you find stuff that you can correlate very closely with the biblical account of creation. Obviously, they're not word for word exact in their details. You guys probably have, you know, stuff you could add on this too, but I think there's some very interesting commonalities that you will find.
The emergent church, is that a fad that's coming into the church, or is it something that's here to stay? And this question is directed mainly to Doug and Jason, since you seem to be from parts of the country where this new movement's rising.
I was actually pretty heavily involved in the emergent church early on when Emergent, which is kind of the umbrella organization over all the emergent churches before it was even emergent. I'm good friends with Brian McLaren, Doug Padgett, Tony Jones, a lot of these guys who are kind of the figures of the emergent movement. Doug Padgett, who's the pastor of Solomon's Porch in Minneapolis, which is kind of one of the flagship churches of the emergent group, I actually helped him start that church. He was my youth pastor in high school, and so he had a profound influence on me and got me involved in this whole deal. And I've walked away from the emergent church in the last 5 years because I believe theologically they're going in directions that are seriously divergent from Orthodox evangelical theology. And in spite of my friendships with a lot of those guys, I have big differences with them. I would say a lot of what you see in the emergent church is just rehashed theological liberalism, cloaked in new clothes, and I'm just, you know, I'm not a big fan of the emergent church movement.
Well, I'm glad I let Jason go first on that one because he's got personal testimony about this. I live in Southern California, but I have no direct connection with the phenomenon itself. I'm not a participant in the movement. My concerns have to do with the understanding that leaders in that movement have about the nature and the importance or relative importance of truth for living a vibrant Christian life and in community with other Christians. The emergent church, when you read the literature, seems to be all about love, community, discipleship, following Jesus with a passion, and putting before the world a positive picture of the attractiveness of the church as a community. Those, I think, are its strengths, but I don't think they are distinctives. They are only distinctives in virtue of being almost the only strengths that they have. What do I mean by that? I think that these ought to be characteristic of churches, whether they're emergent churches or not. So they're not distinctives in that sense. They're just the way they ought to be. What makes the emergent church distinctive is what they seem to downplay or outright deny and say is not important. And that has to do with believing propositions, having reasons to do so, and engaging in a life of the intellect, and taking seriously the importance of evidence for making our, what I call, doxastic commitments, which make a difference.
let's try to achieve unity by ignoring what it is that divides. And the biggest problem is knowing where to draw the line, if a line is ever to be drawn, between the actual people of God and anybody who's not part of the people of God. And I can't figure out where that line is. For someone like Brian McLaren, who wrote a book called The Generous Orthodoxy, I just can't tell. I can see that he wants to embrace others who are outside the pale of traditional historical orthodoxy, but I don't know if he would be willing to include, say, modern-day Gnostics, because I can't tell what criterion he would use for excluding them.
Let me give you an example of this recently. Doug Padgett, who's a close friend of mine, he's one of the senior fellows of the group called Emergent, which is the main organization of this network of churches. He was in a debate in my hometown recently with a friend of mine, a pastor named Bob DeWay. And in the process of this debate, Bob DeWay was pressing Doug on this very question of who is in and who is out in your Emergent church definition. And he brought up the example, what about the Mormons? Would you share Christian fellowship with the Mormons? And Doug danced around the question, you know, well, there's lots of different kinds of Mormons out there. And Bob just kept pressing him. And Doug couldn't give a straight answer. He couldn't say, yes, Mormons are within the Christian fellowship, or no, they're not within the Christian. You know, and I'm sitting there thinking to myself, how can you not be clear on that? These are people who say that Jesus and Satan are brothers, that Jesus was a man who evolved to become a god. He's one God among millions of gods. And you can't clearly come out and say that they are not within the bounds of Orthodox Christianity. And so one of the things that I find troubling with this whole emergent church movement is they have bought so much into this postmodern definition of tolerance. They've become so tolerant that they're afraid to use any sense of biblical discernment in labeling false beliefs and lifestyles. You know, we were talking yesterday, Brian McLaren just a few months ago came out saying the evangelical church needs to take a 5-year moratorium on speaking out against homosexuality. Are you kidding me? As if the church hasn't had that issue in the forefront of our consciousness for the last 2,000 years? That all of a sudden now Brian McLaren has decided that we need to take 5 years off from talking against homosexuality to spend more time studying it and researching it? Because we haven't been doing that for the last 2,000 years.
Because Brian McLaren is confused, no one else can talk about it.
Exactly, you know.
That's what it amounts to.
And So I think one of the main problems with this emergent church movement ties into this issue of discernment, into this idea, like Doug was alluding to, of wanting to be so inclusive that the boundary lines become very blurred in a lot of ways.
Let me offer a contrary view in a sense, because it's not really contrary, because I'm fully in agreement with what Jason and Doug have just said. I'm deeply concerned about the emerging church movement for all of the reasons they identified. However, I think that there is an impulse in what might be called the established church or the evangelical church, insofar as the emergents identify themselves as post-evangelicals largely, almost a knee-jerk reaction to think, well, you've read some bad things about it, or maybe heard some bad things from people like me, and then you think, okay, emergent, bad, all right, and evangelical, good. Well, if you say that, you've missed the point. There's a sense in which every single generation has an emergent church. I mean, I became a Christian during the Jesus movement, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s is when I became a Christian. That was that movement then. Then we were called not the emergent, but the, anybody know what we were called back then?
Old people.
The old people. No, we weren't old people then. We're old people now. We were called the counterculture. And we were emerging from an establishment. That's what we called it then. Now, this wasn't strictly cut across religious lines like this movement is, but you notice that this had an impact in the church, and so you had the counterculture answer was the Jesus movement. And the Jesus movement was controversial. Those of you thin-headed, haired people out there, gray-haired, know what I'm talking about. Some of you guys remember, your dad remembers it. You're too young for that. But there was a lot of controversy because there were new forms that were being introduced into Christian life that upset the apple cart. Remember when contemporary worship services. We have a contemporary worship service at our church. Yes, we have a guitar on the stage. I mean, that was radical, right?
Let's see. In my understanding, and again, because I was a part of this whole thing, the issues with the emergent church are not simply stylistic and
I understand
atmospheric. They are very deep theological issues.
I understand. Yeah. And what I want to say here is to see this from a different perspective. That is, there is always going to be a new generation that needs the gospel that's different from the older generation. And there's going to be a new generation of Christians that are going to need to contextualize the gospel to the new generation, which means there's going to be some changes in some of the forms or the ways we do business that that can be changed to contextualize that gospel, all things to all men. Now, here's the battle line, and here I think you'll be comfortable with this, is that where does the difference between, because I know the point that he's making, there's a question as to whether there's a form that needs to be changed or the message that needs to be changed. And sometimes it's difficult for us in the midst of it to figure out which one's which. And that's why there's a pitched battle back and forth. And some of the old-timers don't want to change the forms because they think they're really essential. You don't put guitars on the stage. That's ungodly. That was in the 60s. Okay, now we don't even think about that anymore. There are real substantive issues at stake here.
Wait a minute. Your church uses guitars?
But there are substantive issues
who
that are in play
him?
Here. That Jason is concerned about, and so am I. But there are also, I think, ground that can be given by some of the older guys, like me, you know, when we're defending things that may not need to be defended. And I think the emergent guys are really good at pointing to some of those things that we've fought about that aren't worth fighting for. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay. So, to summarize or to draw some sort of loose strings together from my point of view, I would say, first of all, that the emergent church is not a monolithic thing. It's actually becoming fragmented. I recently heard a report from a conference of emergent church pastors who were saying, you know, but we're not emergent in the Brian McLaren sense. They were explicitly trying to redefine themselves in contrast to others within the movement. The language, I think, seems to be up for grabs right now, and I wouldn't be trying to own the language myself when it's in such a dynamic state. Second, I would worry a little bit about the cult of personality in this type of thing. I feel concerned about this in general with our big churches where they lose membership because somebody on the staff, maybe the senior minister, is no longer there for whatever reason. We have become followers of individuals when we shouldn't, to a degree that is, to me, I think, a great concern, a reason for concern, real danger. And I see the possibility, because of the cultural elements of this, of there to be more of that kind of thing in this phenomenon. And I would just caution people about that. And here's another connection. It relates to that. This is a conference in Christian apologetics. About reasons to believe the things we do. This is actually sort of shelved among many people in that movement. They think that that's kind of a useless exercise. Maybe we'll backfire and explode in our face. It's not where people are at today. They're not evidence sensitive at all. They're not asking these questions. You know, get over it. And that's kind of the attitude that I get from reading and talking to people within this movement. Well, what are you going to give people instead as a motivation to buy into Christianity? Because that's the language you're reduced to now. Instead of belief, it's some kind of buying into a form of life. Well, now your rhetoric changes from argument on the basis of reason for what's true to some kind of persuasive ad campaign that doesn't have truth as the ultimate objective anymore. And I think that brings us full circle in a conference like this that's all about that. And I don't believe for a moment that people who tell me they're no longer interested in evidence know what they're talking about. Because I believe God created them. They are by design and unavoidably sensitive to evidence, and we just keep right on giving it with mercy and grace, understanding the limitations, but without just taking their word for it when it's convenient for them so they aren't accountable for what they should believe.
Okay, next question.
Since hindsight is 2020, and we recognize that the Old Testament is pointing to the Messiah, Jesus, and is answered in the New Testament, what's been your personal experience when witnessing to the Jewish people as far as what is their hang-up? What's the big block for them? how come they don't recognize Christ like we do, or as easily as we do?
Well, I guess I'll talk.
Because he's from New York area, you know.
Well,
he can answer that.
It's first off, there's always Paul talks about the hardening of the hearts of the Jews being partial and temporary. Partial, there is a remnant. There are believing Jews in every generation who trust in the Lord. And temporary, I'm a premillennialist, so I believe the hardening of the hearts will be removed from the Jews. And that'll be the final domino to fall to usher in the second coming of Jesus Christ to the planet Earth. But part of the gospel going to the Gentiles was to bring the Jews to jealousy. I actually look at this from a little different angle. Keep in mind, the early Jewish apologists who argued against Christianity, Jesus was demon-possessed. He was a sorcerer, says the Talmud. And now you talk to Jewish rabbis, and Jesus has just too good of a reputation. So now you get Orthodox rabbis saying that he was a great teacher. Some even, who's a rabbi, Lapid, who acknowledges the bodily resurrection of Jesus from the dead?
I think it's Lapid, yeah.
Yeah, there are some Jewish rabbis who even go so far to say that he may have been the greatest Jewish prophet ever. It's just that his followers misunderstood his message. And I don't know why God, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest Jewish prophet ever would be the greatest prophet ever. Why would God waste the greatest prophet ever on a bunch of idiots who misunderstood his message? Why not get that message out to the world? So, but whatever the case, it seems that there is something to work with, but there's still that tension is still there. But a lot of Jews don't read the Old Testament. A lot of Orthodox Jews will spend more time with the Talmud. And I don't have time to get into it, but there's a couple examples. Well, maybe just the 700 Club, which I'm not a big fan of. But they just had one of their guys, the guy's a little weird, one of their journalists and all, but he would read Isaiah 53 to Jewish people as they're walking down the streets of Jerusalem and say, well, who's this about? And they would say, oh, that's easy, that's Jesus. And he said, well, you realize I'm quoting from Isaiah, your prophet, 700 years before Jesus walked the earth. And then the people would get mad and say, well, then obviously it's not Jesus. And then go storming away. So Edith Schaefer, in the book Christianity is Jewish, she talks about a situation talking to I believe it was a dentist son who was in college, and how she used Isaiah 53 to plant some seed. Right now, I think things are so bad, Jew and Gentile, that if you plant seed with somebody, that's a great victory. Things are getting so bad that maybe, you know, leading people to Christ, let's just plant some seed and try to move them in the right direction and continue to pray and continue to have relationships with them, and hopefully they'll come to Christ, Jew or Gentile.
I'll make a quick comment. There was a movement about 1906 started by a German Jew named Franz Rosenzweig, and he pushed a view that's very, very popular among intellectual Jews today, and Pinchas Lapid takes a position close to that. It's very, very interesting. The argument goes that Jews have the law. So 30 million people in the world come to God via the law. But Jesus Christ, is the Gentile Messiah for everybody else in the world. So everybody else comes through Jesus. Only Jews are exempt. So there's 30 million exempt people, and everyone else comes through Jesus. Now, Lapid has a little bit of that view. So when I tell people that in 1983, Lapid wrote a book arguing for the resurrection, and it says the evidence is good, and people will just ask you real quickly, so he's a believer? No. Why wouldn't that follow from the resurrection? Well, he thinks it does follow, but it follows for non-Jews. It's just a very fascinating argument that only Jews are exempt from this.
My husband and I were inspired to come to this conference after going to the debate between our pastor, Ken Hutchison, and Ron Sims. And I was wondering if any of you have seen that. Probably Phil has, being from Bremerton. And just wondering if you've seen it, I'd be interested in your comments. And then also an issue that came up that Ron Sims, I believe, said is, Jesus never spoke against homosexuality. How would you answer that?
I didn't see the bait, but I think I'd like to see the two of them play football against each other.
I didn't see the debate either. Since I gave the talk on homosexuality, let me respond to that last question at least. If I understood it, it's the comment that people made that Jesus never spoke against homosexuality. Well, a simple response to that is, so what? What follows from that? Jesus never spoke against wife beating or slavery or gay bashing or pedophilia or a whole host of other things that seem to be wrong. So that's the kind of the quick, down and dirty way of responding, to shift the burden of proof on the other person to make their point a little bit more aggressively than they've done. They think that kind of solves the issue. Well, Jesus never spoke about it. Actually, the so what works two ways. So what follows from that? And so what, why should anybody care what Jesus has to say about anything? Well, the reason people say that is because they want Jesus on their team. Now, that's an interesting dynamic, isn't it? Why would people care whether Jesus is on their team or not? And people do this a lot. New Agers say they claim Jesus, you know. Just this earlier in the discussion, the Jews now want to say, well, Jesus was one of our greatest prophets. Why should people care? Because it seems to be self-evident that Jesus was someone with credibility that you need to contend with. And if Jesus was against something, you're up against a significant foe. All right? So since Jesus wasn't against homosexuality, he's on our side, is the reasoning. Well, it's implicitly affirming Jesus' authority, but secondly, it doesn't seem to follow that because he didn't mention anything he was against, of these things as being against them, that he was in favor of them, and these other examples are, I guess, point that out. But it also, it really does reflect a low Christology, because on Christian viewpoint, Jesus wasn't just a man, he was also God. And therefore, all of the other biblical texts, whether written by Paul or Moses, all were Jesus' words after a fashion, in that Jesus was the second person of the Trinity, and God himself was the author of these words. And so if Jesus was God and God was responsible for the Bible, then Jesus did have something to say about homosexuality. And finally, Jesus didn't speak directly about homosexuality, but he had very high praise for Moses. And Moses did speak against homosexuality in Leviticus 18 and 20. And it seems implicitly in the account of Genesis and and Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. So, I mean, all of these things seem to me to demonstrate that this is simply a dead-end kind of argument that people offer. But many apparently are impressed by its brilliance, which is beyond me.
And, if I could add a passage of Scripture that may be helpful to the point he made about Christology, and that would be John 17, where Jesus is praying in his so-called high priestly prayer before he leaves the earth for his disciples, who will then be his emissaries into the world. And he's praying for their protection and for their authority. He knows they're going to be persecuted, but he is investing them with the mission, right, to carry the word. And it's going to be fuller than anything he said on this earth. And he says that he prays for them, and not only for them, but for all those who believe on me through their word. Their word has authority. That is demonstrated by the way he addresses his Father on their behalf. That's why he asks for special protection for them. He also asks for unity for them that reflects the unity between himself and the Father. And I like what Greg said about Christology. Because you don't even have to make a point about Christology, really. You could make it a point about Trinitarianism, because you could say, look, one member of the Trinity or other is responsible for all of what the Scriptures contain. And Jesus Christ called himself one with the Father. They had this peculiar unity. And however you slice it, right, if you're trying to pit the authority of Jesus against explicit statements elsewhere in Scripture that make people uncomfortable about the teaching of Scripture on homosexuality, you're really asking for trouble on a division of the Trinity.
Yeah, I'd like to add, too, it seems to me that Jesus' biggest problem with the way the rabbis of his day were interpreting the law, when you look at the Sermon on the Mount, was that the rabbis were looking at outward obedience, and Jesus was going beyond that You know, like we're not under the law, we're under grace. Well, what that means, we're supposed to obey God from the heart because now the Holy Spirit indwells us. And so he's looking for obedience from the heart. And I don't see him butting heads, like you mentioned, with the law of Moses on issues of homosexuality. The other thing is we do know what he was for. And, you know, Matthew 19, he makes it real clear that God intended it from creation, a man and a woman, and then he said the two become one flesh. So he was real clear on what he viewed the biblical view of sexuality to be.
We also know what he thought about promiscuity. And so that's another area to explore on that point. You know, what counts as acceptable behavior within the gay community? Would that qualify for censure on that point? Go ahead, Gary.
I just wonder if you're done.
So then I would...
Just one real quick sidebar on something Greg said. It's real interesting that everybody wants Jesus' blessing. Okay. Friday night, I gave 5 statements. Jesus is the only founder of a major world religion. 2. Then I added another one about suffering as I, you know, broke out one of those on the cross. Well, here's a 7th one. Jesus is the only founder of a major world religion who is revered by all the other religions. I mean, think about that. In the Quran, almost 100 verses in the Quran on Jesus, peace be upon him. Right? I mean, you don't put Jesus down for a Muslim either. And I think they've made it clear recently with this cartoon thing. It's just not Muslim. It's not just Muhammad. You don't do that to Jesus either. I mean, that's incredible from other religions. And that has changed with Jews recently, that he's a prophet. And even as far as to say he's the Messiah for everybody else, except for 30 million Jews. So this is an extraordinary view of Jesus.
Do you ever notice how many New Agers claim to be the reincarnation of Jesus? You know, a lot of people make that claim. And I was in India a few years ago, and there was this local guru there in Madras, and he claimed to be this. And I thought, this does not help your case at all. Because if reincarnation is to make you better, you know, every reincarnation you work off karmic debt before you're finally out of the system. 2,000 years ago, Jesus was wonderful, and he's still in the system. As good as he was 2,000 years ago, he's still in the system. This is not encouraging to me, being reincarnated. Anyway, that's, those who have ears to hear, let them
hear.
And
if you were him, you're going in the wrong direction. If you were him, you're going in the wrong direction.
All right, next question. Do we know about what percentage of the world's population is professing Christian? And if we all have this innate sense of the moral right, why would there be such a small percentage that would be professing and aware of the truth of Christ and of God?
I thought there are two questions. One is, what is the percentage of the earth population that are professing Christians? And the second one is, if we're really correct, why isn't there more?
More what?
More professing Christians?
I just saw some statistics just the other day that of the 6 billion people on earth, 2 billion claim to be Christians. That's 1/3. And what's Islam, 1.4, something like that?
Islam is about a little over 20%, but Christianity is right now is growing at a faster rate than Islam is.
Right. Contrary to what you hear in the press, where you hear that Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world, talk to some of the missiologists. Christianity is growing faster, but about one in three people claim to be Christians.
I think we still have to recognize the reality, though, that at the end of the day, when it's all said and done, we're on the narrow road.
Yeah.
And broad is the road that leads to destruction. So, you know, these debates, I think we get in these arguments over, well, are the Muslims growing faster? Are we? And we feel good about ourselves when we're able to say, well, we're the largest religion. Friends, at the end of the day, there's going to be a lot more people populating hell than there is heaven. And that should be our motivation to go out into the world and take the gospel to people.
One other real quick stat. Ron Sider published a book on the importance of evangelism, among other things. That's the second time that's happened to me.
And get a said, hint there, Gary. What does that mean?
Hey, no.
Go ahead. So,
he said the number of people who are unreached today who've never heard the gospel is down to 1 billion. That's interesting. That 5 billion out of 6 billion have heard the gospel in some way.
I never understood the charge, and I've heard this just last week, that if Christianity were really true, more people would believe in it. That presumes that all it requires is for something to be true for people to believe in it. That, I mean, that's it. It doesn't make any sense. There are so many different beliefs in the world that people hold. How can that point of view ever survive? Listen, if God really didn't exist, nobody would believe that he did. I mean, it works the other side, too. This kind of presumes that the reason that there are only people have beliefs only for, in a sense, rational reasons. Sometimes people hold the views that they do for emotional reasons. Sometimes for prejudicial reasons. Sometimes they do it just because they're plain old bullheaded, it seems to me. There are lots of different rationales that people actually have for the views they say they hold. And so it doesn't strike me as evidence at all against Christianity that that more people don't believe it, even if that's the case. You can't look at the population statistics. You got to look at the claims and the evidence that's involved. It was kind of funny. I told you about that story yesterday about being on that TV show with the Sikh, and he challenged me, and he said, you people who believe like you believe, there are very few people in the world that believe that. You know, that Jesus is the only way, and everybody's, this tolerant type. Well, actually, this isn't really true. And I missed my opportunity because I thought afterwards, I could have said this, but I probably, the better angel of my nature wouldn't even have said it even if I had the chance to. But it struck me as rather odd that a Sikh was attacking my view as being inconsequential because such a few people hold it, when Sikhism is the smallest major religion in the world. It's just a very small... I didn't make that point, but I might have. It just goes to make the point, though, that the size of the followers tell you nothing about the truthfulness of the belief.
Here's another consideration, too. Why don't more people believe? My father was speaking at a large university out on the East Coast this last year on the scientific evidence for creation. And after one of his lectures, a biologist at this university asked him to go out to dinner with him. And in the process of their conversation, this biologist, he said to my father, he said, "Ron, I know what you're saying is true, but I'm still going to believe in evolution." And my father said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Because it's morally comfortable." He said, "As soon as I admit that there's a God, then I become morally accountable to that God. And I don't want to be morally accountable to anybody." And I think that that's a real reality for a lot of people in our world today.
I told the group in the breakout session on emotional doubt that I've been doing research for about 15 years with a clinical psychologist, and we've surveyed people and come up with an instrument to measure doubt. And the vast majority of doubters, questioners, doubt for emotional reasons. So it is far from true that if you have the best case, people are going to fall over themselves to come to you. Most people doubt for emotional reasons. And by the way, that's unbelievers as well as believers. So it's just a real interesting niche. When Greg said earlier he would rather recast the term faith as trust, which, by the way, is a synonym for the Greek word pistuo. And he was giving lists of what faith has become. I thought he was going to say feeling, because another popular one is, well, I feel. And we just say that, and they almost take that in the sense of I'm thinking. But I think, according to this research, most of what we do is feeling, and less of it's thinking.
One person I was talking to said they have no need for Jesus. They told me they have four goals in life, and the first one was to keep their parents happy, second, get a cell phone, third, get a nice car, four, go to a nice college like Stanford or somewhere in California, and they believe that when you die, you just cease to exist. They say they're perfectly happy, and they feel no need for Jesus. What do you say to that? How can I get them to realize how much they need him?
This guy I was telling you about on this airplane flight over here yesterday, he basically said the exact same thing to me. He said, this is what I believe life's all about. Do the best I can, get a good job, have a good family, blah, 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 blah. And at the end of the day, I die and that's it. And I said, okay, that's fine. All right. Let's assume that's true. But then we talked about that for a while. But then I said, let's assume that my story's true. Let's just think about this for a second. What if my story is true? And what if instead of when you die, your body just gets put in the grave and you end up rotting away? What if instead you're going to end up standing in front of a God? And what if that God's going to say to you, what did you do with Jesus Christ? Because if that story is true, then suddenly that changes everything. And see, what I did with this guy then is that led us into a huge conversation where we started talking about the claims of Jesus Christ and the resurrection of Christ. And we went a long way in that conversation, and he was really just very open to hearing about this because I took him and I got him to ask the question, what if it's true? And I said, look, you don't have to believe it, but just think about what if it was? And work with that framework for a minute. So I don't know, that might be a helpful technique to share, and I'm sure you guys have some excellent recommendations as well. So,
Dr. Habermas co-authored a book with J.P. Moreland on immortality, the other side of death, and that would be an excellent book where he looks at near-death experiences and things of that sort, and they give evidence for life after death. So that might be another good approach as well.
I think that's an excellent approach, by the way. And Pascal, there's been a lot of... No. Let me tell you about this book, Immortality.
It's a great book. It's a sensational book. I agree.
You know how you know the difference between the part JP wrote and the part I wrote? It's really, really easy. I wrote the chapter on heaven, and he wrote the chapter on hell. It kind of works with our personalities and whatnot. I think it's an excellent way. There's been a lot of talk about Pascal this weekend from various of the speakers. And actually, Pascal used that. That was one of Pascal's arguments. Think about when you die and the finality of death. And, you know, if Ecclesiastes 3:11 is true, that God's placed eternity in our hearts, that was mentioned this weekend too, then maybe it is that we have a longing. I did a lecture years ago. Actually, Doug was there, but did a lecture years ago at University of Toronto, where I simply ran quotes up, one after the other, from non-believers about life after death. And one of the most influential psychotherapists in the world said something like this in a bestseller. He said, "The highest idea ever penned by man is that we can live after death." Next sentence, "Too bad it's not true." That kind of longing is the kind of thing that we can see in Ecclesiastes 3:11. I think there's a lot of ways to get to the gospel. And it's not just to hammer them with evidence for the resurrection or hammer them with the existence of God as, you know, a starting point, or the Bible's reliable or whatever. I think with this generation in many ways is more religious than the previous generation. I've said this before, and I'm not trying to be detracting, but if we believe the statistics and the reports on research, this generation's not as good a thinking generation, but they're a good feeling generation. And they come at religion from a felt need kind of viewpoint. And I think saying things like Jason was just saying, drawing things out in terms of felt need, is a real good way to go after this. And then bringing the evidence in anytime you can do that.
I do see the dilemma. Did you say cell phone was one of the... I do see the dilemma trying to help somebody understand their felt need for Jesus when they think it's a cell phone. But what I would say is maybe what you want to do is you want to ask this kind of person, so why is that important to you? And then wait for an answer. This might be something that she's never thought about. And then ask her, but what if you don't experience these things? How, you know, then what? And why would your life amount to more? Why would it be more significant if you did achieve these things? And how many people do you know who have said, my life is so meaningful now because I have an LG cell phone with Verizon service and a BMW, and I just got into Stanford. Only very young people who haven't experienced these things to the hilt yet, right? So I think you could give her evidence of people who have experienced these things, and then it turned out it wasn't enough. You could say to her, I think you're on a pathway towards never being able to be satisfied with what you have, and so you're probably looking in the wrong place.
You know, Dr. Habermas quoted from Ecclesiastes, and Solomon was the guy who had everything, and it was all empty. He did not find satisfaction until he put God in the equation, and so maybe maybe you can encourage your friend to read through Ecclesiastes with you, something along those lines.
Thank you so much for all the brothers who gave to the body of Christ this weekend, and we praise God for the abilities that God gave you all to use for this. My question is two-part. The first part is, who is your favorite apologist from the Holy Bible, and why? And the second part of the question is, there are so many young people in the church and budding apologists. For a generation that does not study enough, or the generation that does not is so fast-paced, how do you put a stone into their shoe as an apologist or as a Christian?
You were asking who our favorite apologist from the Bible is?
Yes.
In scriptures?
Yes.
And then the second part was, I believe, what's one of our key arguments that we use in sharing apologetically with somebody, or? Yeah, okay. Okay, all right.
Shoot him. I guess I'll start. I'd say, so you're saying our favorite apologist who is from the Bible. I would probably just to be somewhere between Paul and Apollos. Paul, I like the way he went in the synagogues and went through the Old Testament scriptures arguing Jesus is the Messiah. When they rejected it, then he went to the marketplace and was willing to even quote from Greek poetry and Greek philosophy to make his case and argue for God as the creator, and then try to go right to the resurrection, which probably make Dr. Habermas happy. But the way Paul seemed to be talking about Apollos and chapters 1 and 2, and Luther believed Apollos may have written Hebrews, so he was a real big gun there. So, oh, and about reaching people with feelings is a really good book. Peter Kreft, is that the right way to pronounce it? I've been calling the guy Kreef for years, but it's Kreft, I guess. But Peter Kreft is Christianity for Modern Pagans. He has large portions from Blaise Pascal's Pensées, and then he gives his a little running commentary. And Pascal really believed, he actually held a high view of reason, but he had a low view of man's character. So he believed that we use our reason to just argue, to justify whatever we believed already. But I think that's a really good book where Pascal is pulling at the strings of the heart. And if Pascal can start with the feelings and still bring you to the truth, but in the end, the person's still got to make that decision themselves.
I think you've got to admire a guy who had the following effect on people. His opponents got tired of asking him questions because he just drilled them to the point where they were helpless. And all they could do was plot to just eliminate him. All right? That guy qualifies as an all-time favorite apologist. That's what happened with Jesus. And, you know, there's so many lessons to learn from Jesus about how he did apologetics, how he answered questions with questions that probed the assumptions behind their questions, which were the kind of questions Carl was saying, you know, we got to be careful that we're not teaching through our questions. That's what the religious leaders were trying to do. And he knew it, and he got through to them, and he just peeled back the layers. He's such a good model for us. And he did it in a way that's so simple that we can actually do some of those same things ourselves without being the Son of God. We just try to follow his example and asking those kinds of questions. I like that about Jesus. Another thing I like about Jesus is...
So take that, Mr. Paul fan.
No, I'm...
He's going to trade now.
I want to take back my answer. Forget Paul and Apollos. Jesus
Go
is my
Jesus.
Favorite apologist.
Go Jesus.
You converted me.
I'm with him, too.
There you go. So
You know, but another thing that's really wonderful about, I'm not talking about who my favorite apologist is as much as I am about what's so wonderful about the best apologist that ever lived, right? And that we all agree is. We can like different ones for different things because we can relate to them in certain ways, certain events. I mean, I think of Acts 17 as just an incredibly brilliant methodology used by Paul in dealing with people in apologetics. I like that. But another thing that just I find so admirable about Jesus and gives me so much hope in what I do is that he himself could not convince everyone to believe. And it wasn't his fault. So I take great comfort in that, in knowing that it's not my job, it's not our job to bring people to Christ. You know, what we do is we bring Christ to them. And then they will do with him whatever they will. And that's part of his mercy too. That's what was so wonderful about this morning. I had the privilege of seeing people saying, you know, I will. And I'd still love to hear from any one of you that like that to come and tell me about, you know, your new relationship with Christ. But he is quite a model, and we could learn a lot from him about evangelism and apologetics.
My favorite apologist is Balaam's donkey. There's not much more convincing than a talking jackass, you know what I'm saying? So, I don't know. I mean, you see a talking donkey. What more do you need? You know what I'm saying? I'm in.
All right, next question.
Well, Greg Coco mentioned another way to the gospel, and my this refers to my own preferential angle at the present time, and it's linguistic in nature. There's a rich vein of apologetics that was used in the recorded word of God through its Hebrew language letters, root words, and letters themselves, or words, I mean, of the Old Testament in particular, which strongly reveals the intelligent, complex mind of God and his heart and how he deals with us and how we deal with each other. How come this conference did not touch upon it, and how aware are you of this approach in apologetics, and do you see it as an emerging tool in our arsenal for giving a reason for Christianity?
Were you asking me that question?
All of you. Any of you.
I couldn't understand it.
No, any of you.
Well, too many parts.
No, it's one part, one question, very basically. Well, okay, well, I'll say it again. There's a rich vein in apologetics of language, of Hebrew language in revealing the mind of God. It's amazing how much you can discover about the mind of God in the words, letters, and root words of Hebrew themselves, of Hebrew. And it's amazing, rich vein, and I didn't see any of you guys this weekend touch on it. I was wondering if you're aware of it, and if so, do you see it emerging? Because at the end times, the age of the Gentiles is going to end, and we're going to have the age of the Jews again. Well, the Jews speak Hebrew, and we talked about, you know, how do we reach the Jews?
Well, this sounds like more like a statement than it does a question.
No, I mean, the question is it...
Why don't we know all about that?
I was wondering if you guys have been working on it any, or do you see anybody working on it?
You guys working on it?
Well, I mean,
we're not working on it.
No. Okay. Most of the Jews I know don't speak Hebrew.
No, I don't.
So, I mean, I don't know how good that's going to be for me, but...
I'm Jewish.
Okay.
I'm a Christian, and I find it to be the most exciting, amazing apologetics. I love every one of your apologetics.
Well, maybe you ought to work on it then. Write a book. You'll be the guy.
But I mean, I want to know, you guys, I respect and reveal you. What's the word? I respect you guys so much and thoroughly enjoy this conference so much. So I'm...
No, I didn't really mean to be glib. I mean, I think, you know, different people have kind of different capabilities and exposures, and this is something you're hot about, and you have some native capability, and I think go with it.
Yeah, I'm a little bit isolated where I live on the peninsula, no excuse, but I was just wondering where you... You guys are tuned into apologetics.
I have not heard anything about this particular approach myself.
It's Carl's fault.
Yeah.
Because Carl put this conference together, and he knew who he was bringing.
Shame on you, Carl.
And
demerits.
It should go to the committee for next year.
All right. Thank you. Next question.
If somebody was seeking whether there was a God or not, and they wanted to look at the most significant evidence that has come forward in the last, say, 100 years, what would you point them to?
The most significant evidence?
In the last 100 years. For the existence of God.
For the existence of God.
I think the anthropic principle, I mean, that immediately comes to mind. It's just the idea that the universe is very fine-tuned to such a degree in so many different ways that it can't really be reasonably accounted for by chance. It seems like somebody's there tinkering with the universe and has set it in a certain way. And there's lots of evidences for this. The intelligent design movement is somewhat grounded here in this city with the Discovery Institute, and many fine players in that institute have written on this point. But I suggest that it is one of the most significant things because it's had such a powerful influence on non-believers. One that Gary has been involved with, and maybe you can say something about that guy that you've been involved with, the atheist guy.
Anthony Flew?
Yes. Yeah, is that right? Yeah, he was deeply influenced by this argument too, as have other people been influenced by this new scientific evidence that points to an intelligent designer.